All right, so this morning we're going to talk about, we're coming to the end of this study in the Reformation. We've been at it 5 or 6 months now, and I think it's been good and edifying. We're going to begin sort of the last leg here. We're going to talk about what's commonly called the Counter-Reformation. So the Counter-Reformation is the Roman Catholic Church's actions that they took in many ways to reform the church. So there's a discussion and a debate about whether or not the Counter-Reformation, and there's some assumption inherent in that name that says it was a response to something, i.e. it was a response to the Protestant Reformation. Some Catholic theologians argue that the reforms that were seen as part of the Counter-Reformation had already begun. People within the Roman Catholic Church itself had realized that there were some abuses going on, specifically in the area of indulgences and in the education of priests, which is basically lack thereof. There were a lot of, frankly, illiterate priests within the context of the Roman Catholic Church. So there's some debate as to whether or not, who initiated the reforms. It is historically, though, referred to as the Counter-Reformation. Certainly the Protestant Reformation brought on a lot of the details of what happened as part of the Counter-Reformation. Now, if you go to this timeline that I had handed out previously, and if you can get together and share. So the Counter-Reformation is typically about a 100-year time frame that begins in 1545. So on the top of one of the flaps on the timeline, there's a 1545. Do you see it there? Mm-hmm. 1545. And it goes from 1545 to 1648. So about 100 years is typically what historically is seen as the Counter-Reformation. 1545, what's significant in 1545 is you have the initiation of what is historically called the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent, as you see there on the timeline, it ran from 1545 to 1563, so a very, very long time frame. They met more than 20 times over those 18 years, and we are going to spend at least next week, if not the next 2 weeks, talking about the Council of Trent. This is a printout of the Council of Trent document. Okay, if you print it out on single side, one page per sheet, this particular version of the Council of Trent turns out to be about 156 pages. Okay, so this is my reading for the next 2 weeks so that we can pull out from it the salient points. But the Council of Trent is very important in the history of Christianity and the history of the Roman Catholic Church. And what we'll see is that it was at the Council of Trent where the divisions between Roman Catholicism and Protestants were finalized. There was no going back. There is no going back once Trent is published in 1563. Okay? The two sides cannot be reconciled. And so back in the 90s, there were a couple of documents called ECT, or Evangelicals and Catholics Together. That document was roundly criticized and rejected by those who have a very reformed bent, i.e. R.C. Sproul, John MacArthur, were actually in a long meeting with some people over ECT and utterly rejected that document. Okay, and we'll see from the documents of Trent it's themselves why that is the case, okay? Why there is no longer any reconciliation possible between Protestants and Roman Catholics. All right? So let's walk through this timeline. I just want to give an overview of these 100 years of the Counter-Reformation. So you see in 1545 to 1563, the Council of Trent, we're going to talk about that extensively, as I mentioned. 1546, Luther dies. 1549, the Church of England produces the first revision of the Book of Common Prayer, and there was an attempt in that to sort of walk this line between Protestantism and Roman Catholicism. The Book of Common Prayer underwent many revisions, and a lot of those revisions took it much more to the Protestant side, as we'll see in a bit. Also under 1549, you see this term Jesuit. So we'll talk a little bit more about the Jesuits later today, Lord willing. But a Jesuit is a Roman Catholic order. It's called an order. And there are lots of Roman Catholic orders, but the Jesuits were very important to the Counter-Reformation, and they exist even today. There are many, many members of the Jesuit order within Roman Catholicism. 1554, Queen Mary Tudor, daughter of Henry VIII, she restores Roman Catholicism to England. She bans Protestant translations of the Bible, and she persecutes Protestants. And so the historical numbers are around 300 or so Protestant preachers that Queen Mary, who is also known as Bloody Mary, that's correct, all right, about 300 Protestant preachers she ends up burning. To make an attempt to reinstate Roman Catholicism in England. She's only in power for about 6 years, right? In 1558, 1559, depends on what you read, Queen Elizabeth I becomes Queen of England and Supreme Governor of the Church of England. She is trying to reconcile these, but she has definite Protestant leanings. She's taking England back to Protestantism, okay? And she's actually in power for more than four decades. She was relatively young when she became queen, and she is queen past 1600. I skipped over 1555, the Peace of Augsburg, and this is very important because what's happening now in Germany, which is part of the Roman Empire, right, is there's this peace that says each of the individual region is allowed to adopt whatever type of religion they want, right? This was a very tenuous peace, as we will see as we get to the end of the Counter-Reformation, but this happened in 1555. 1560, very important. Pastor Mike, if he were here, he would talk extensively about this. The publication of the Geneva Bible in Switzerland. And this is the first time in history that a Bible is printed with verse divisions, right? And so the Geneva Bible is incredibly important. You can go and get a Kindle edition for relatively cheap with the margin notes and everything. Beware, the F's are S's and the S's are F's and the U's are V's and the V's are U's and that sort of thing. And so you got to work your way through it. But this is a very, very important Bible. It was actually the Bible that was brought over to the New World on the Mayflower. It was not the King James Version. It was the 1560 Geneva. Okay, very, very important. And then John Knox gets a nod here for his bringing reforms and Protestantism to Scotland. John Knox, very, very important reformer that we didn't talk a lot about. 1563, the Heidelberg Catechism, most widely held Protestant doctrinal statement for centuries. In fact, in my house over dinner on Tuesdays and Thursdays, my family's working through the Heidelberg Catechism. It is incredibly clear and concise and instructive. I commend it to you just in your devotional time as you're looking through, looking for opportunities just to grow. It's in a question and answer format, obviously, as a catechism, and very, very important. And then also in 1563, John Fox publishes the Fox's Book of Martyrs, and I brought my copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs here. And so this is a very interesting read, and it begins with Stephen, the persecution of Stephen in Acts chapter 7 and 8, and it comes up to, and I don't remember exactly what the last year is, it might be Bloody Mary. But so this is sort of a Christian history of those who have given their lives for the cause of the gospel, so very interesting read. 1564 is when the term Puritan is first used, and it's first used in England for those who want to, as they're called, purify the Church of England from, as we previously mentioned, right, if you go back up to the Book of Common Prayer, 1549, it was an attempt to sort of walk that line between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism, and the Puritans now are beginning to want to purify the worship in England and eliminate all of the traditional Roman Catholic and what we would call high liturgy of the churches, and get back to the simplicity of the gospel. They were throwing things off, like vestments and those types of things. All right, and so the Puritans are born in 1564, and it's the same year that John Calvin dies. And as we mentioned, 1563 was the end and publishing of the Council of Trent, all 156 pages of it. Okay, so very important time, and the divisions are growing very clear. Let's see, 1570, this same Queen Elizabeth is excommunicated by the Pope, and then there's some persecution of Catholics that goes on in England. Book of Concord, 1577, very important historical document. 1582, the Douay-Rheims Bible, which was a Roman Catholic Bible that was translated into English from the Latin Vulgate. This is a very important event in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, because if you remember, right, people like Wycliffe and others were persecuted for translating the Bible into English. And then here we have the Douay-Rheims Bible, 1582. 1598, so there's these French Protestants, they're called Huguenots. If you remember talking about John Calvin, we talked about the Huguenots, who were under severe persecution in France, and those who weren't caught and killed, they left France and went to Geneva. Okay? And so these French Protestants, these Huguenots, went to Geneva and they were trained under John Calvin. Right? So these are solid theological Protestants. So in 1598, when the Huguenots are then allowed to preach and teach after 30 years of persecution in France, they are very well trained, right, in Calvin's Protestantism. 1601, this Dutch Reformed theologian, I don't know how Reformed he is, but anyway, he wasn't Roman Catholic, but this guy, Jacobus Arminius, he sets forth these doctrines emphasizing man's ability to choose Christ and Christ's death for all people. So if you actually flip over the pad there, you can see the 5 points of Arminianism on the left-hand side and the 5 points of Calvinism on the right. This is a clear contrast. If you remember, a couple of years ago, we did a series through the Canons of Dort, which will come up in this timeline. And what we said at that time was the 5 points of Calvinism are not original with Calvin. If you remember, the 5 points are original with Arminius. And then the Canons of Dort refuted each of those 5 points. Okay, so the 5 points of Calvinism grow out of the Canons of Dort, the Synod of Dort, right? And they are a response to the Remonstrants, who were the followers of Jacob Arminius. Okay, so Arminius, he's there in 1601, and he begins to write essentially against Calvinism and the doctrine of election. Let's see. At some point in here, it doesn't say, I don't think, King James comes the first comes to power. You see the gunpowder plot in London there. King James was, there was an attempt on his life that failed. And then around this time, 1604, actually, King James I commissions a new English translation of the Bible, which takes 7 years. And so the first edition of the King James Bible appears in 1611. It's also known as the Authorized Bible. It was not real popular at the beginning, but then becomes very popular after some of the mistakes that were made in it got fixed. And for at least 3 centuries, the King James Bible was the most popular English Bible in the entire world. Okay, very, very important As I mentioned, in 1618, the Synod of Dort responds to Arminius's five criticisms of Calvinism, as we saw previously, and we have there's a series on the Canons of Dort. I think it's 9 or 10 parts, actually out on sermon audio that we did here in Sunday school, so you can go listen to that if you like. 1620, we have the Pilgrims. They reject the Church of England, and they sail to America. They don't come straight to America. Some of the Pilgrims actually go to the Netherlands for a while, for a short time, and then ultimately come to America on the Mayflower. The Puritans follow them, and as I mentioned previously, the Pilgrims come with the 1560 Geneva Bible. There's an interesting thing in 1629. So Orthodox patriarchs. So remember, we talked about in the history of the church the Great Schism of 1054. The church splits into the West, which is the Roman Catholics, and the East, which are the Eastern Orthodox. And this Eastern Orthodox patriarch, Cyril, befriends Protestants and presents the earliest known copy of the Bible in Greek to Charles I of England, okay? And so maybe someday in here we'll do a series on textual criticism and the lines of transmission of the New and Old Testament texts and that sort of thing. But so this is very, very important, though. The Codex Alexandrius, and Codex has a very specific meaning here and all these other things. But anyway, you see the Orthodox, the Eastern Church, coming together with the Protestants. 1642, civil war in England, power struggle between Charles I and Parliament. Oliver Cromwell, who is a member of Parliament, he defeats the king's troops, as it says there, and he seeks tolerance for many Protestant groups. 1647, the Westminster Confession is accepted as the statement of Presbyterianism in Scotland and England. So this is a time of confessions as a whole. So if you remember our own confession that we adhere to, that shows up in the bulletin every week and that we have as our statement of faith on our website, is the 1646 London Baptist Confession of Faith. Right, so around this time, there's a lot of confessions being written. That 1646 confession is expanded and updated in the 1680s, which culminates in what's called the 1689 Second London Baptist Confession of Faith. It looks very similar to the Westminster Confession in a lot of places, obviously differing on things like baptism and church government. But the 1689 is, if you find a confessional Reformed Baptist church, there aren't a lot of them, but if you find one, usually there'll be 1689 London Baptist Confession. And so that it's a long and good and edifying document that identifies the Pope as Antichrist, which also the Westminster Confession did as well. 1647, also the beginnings of the Quaker movement. Under preacher George Fox, right? We're pretty familiar with them here. And then in 1648, very, very important, we're going to talk about this more as we wrap up today, the end of the 30 Years' War. The Catholics and Protestants are given equal rights in most of the Holy Roman Empire. And so this is the end, essentially, of the Counter-Reformation. There was a peace, finally, between the Protestants and the Roman Catholics. Not theologically, right, but politically and militarily. It truly was a 30 years war. It began in 1618. It ended in 1648. And so in 1648, now that there's this peace, at least militarily and politically, this is typically referred to as the end of the Counter-Reformation. So just a few more points on the Counter-Reformation as a whole. And then next week we'll pick up in detail, because I think that the theological... You can go read the history if you want in an encyclopedia. There's actually a couple of really good Wikipedia articles that you can go and sort of fill in the gaps on what's going on between 1545 and 1648. But a couple of high-level comments as we wrap up this 100 years. There were a lot of religious battles over this 100-year time frame. Okay, and when I say battles, I mean battles. Okay, Scott taught last week on Ulrich Zwingli, who was injured in a battle as it being a chaplain and a warrior for the army. And so these were going on all of the time. Is a very much a political struggle between those who adopted Protestantism in their region and those who adopted Roman Catholicism in their region. So much of in the wake of the Reformation, in the wake of Luther, many of the regions in Western Europe became Protestant. We've seen that, right? We've seen it in Switzerland, even Jan Hus coming before in Czechoslovakia. There were these tendencies for these regions to become Protestant, and during the course of these 100 years, the Roman Catholics they would. Through some of their own armies and through some mercenary armies, tried to take back these lands that had converted to Protestantism. And it was very much a political and military struggle. There are some really important names that you may have heard of that are part of the Counter-Reformation. So, Ignatius of Loyola. And so, right, I don't know, did they win last night? Did the University of Chicago Loyola win last night? They lost last night. So, but anyway, there's a name there. He's the founder of the Jesuit order. And we'll talk more about that in a bit. Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. These are two of the more famous mystics of the Counter-Reformation time frame. I brought with me here this book. It's called Ascent of Mount Carmel by John of the Cross. He's a mystic. I did not buy this book. This book was bought for me, and I have not read it all the way through. I picked it up and thumbed through it every once in a while. But there was a lot of, and they weren't the only two. There were other mystics, people who were looking to be utterly caught up into the divine, is essentially what they were doing at the time. Union with the divine. There's another famous book by John of the Cross called Dark Night of the Soul, which is kind of it's actually found its way into our vernacular. So anyway, those are out there. I don't know that they're very edifying reading, but just so you know. Francis de Sales and Philip Neri, Neri was actually a kind of an anti-Jesuit, so they certainly weren't solid, you know, in terms of the beliefs that were being developed during this 100 years during the Counter-Reformation. The veneration of the Virgin Mary heightened near the end of the 1500s. For example, the victory at the Battle of Leporito, where at this particular time the forces of the Roman Catholic Empire defeated the forces of the Ottoman Empire. The victory there in battle was accredited to the Blessed Virgin Mary. The veneration of Mary became especially popular during the 17th century, the 1600s, and was something that the Jesuits were very much focused on at that time. So this veneration of Mary that we have and we know so well today as part of the modern Roman Catholic dogma finds its root in many ways in during the Counter-Reformation time. Our modern calendar, the Gregorian calendar, is actually introduced and adopted by what was the entire known world at the time for the most part in 1582. It was very controversial leading up to that time because some of the people that were working on these calendars were heliocentric, right, which is a fancy word that means that the Earth revolves around the sun. The sun is the center of our galaxy. Up until this time, people believed and the church affirmed that the Earth was the center of the galaxy, and the sun revolved around the Earth, and people like Copernicus came along and were challenging that. Galileo is actually living during the time of this Counter-Reformation, and he begins to agree with Copernicus on this heliocentrism, and that wasn't very popular. It was declared to be heretical by the Roman Catholic Church for supposedly trying to reinterpret the geocentric nature of the Bible, right? And so these people, for many decades, were called heretics. So the Gregorian calendar was introduced in 1582. The Jesuits. Let's talk a little bit about the Jesuits, or the Society of Jesus. So they were formed in September 1540. So, as I mentioned, the founder was Ignatius of Loyola in Paris. Ignatius wrote a document called Spiritual Exercises that emphasized poverty, chastity, and obedience to the Pope. Okay. Ignatius had a very military focus. Okay, he had a military background. In fact, he didn't become a real sort of religious order type person until he had been injured in a battle, and he was laying in the hospital, and he was recovering, and then he became very, very devout, and he wanted to set himself apart for religion. And so the writings of Ignatius and the Jesuit order generally has a lot of military language in it. So if you happen to stumble upon these writings. Some of the good things that came out of the Jesuits is that they were very focused on educating priests who were, as I mentioned previously, very uneducated during the Middle Ages. So you had priests in small bishoprics or small regions, and they only had a Bible in Latin, and they didn't know. They couldn't read Latin. They didn't understand Latin. All they knew was what they were told, and all they were told was what could get to them out in the country. And so the Jesuits, even to this day, are very much focused on educating Roman Catholics. A lot of the documentation that is created or has been created to educate Roman Catholics, a lot of that comes out of the Jesuits. They were very, very educated men, and they're very important to the Counter-Reformation. They're also very missionary-minded. They have, this military mindset that they're going into these unexplored places, and they're going in to conquer the pagans, not in a military way, but in a spiritual way. And so the Jesuits were very, very missionary-minded throughout the Counter-Reformation, and still are today. And they were going all over the world and establishing Christian missions to pagan peoples. Finally, the 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648, it is one of the longest and most destructive conflicts in human history. Almost entirely on the continent of Western Europe, there were 8 million fatalities as part of the 30 Years' War. Now, they were not all directly military fatalities, right? But some of them had secondary effects, right? So the battles, if you were going to cut off a region, for example, for the purpose of military, so you're cutting off food, water, supplies, a lot of those 8 million, for example, were plague, right? Just because people were dying because they were sick. But that was a direct result, a secondary effect of the 30 Years' War and what was going on there. It began as a religious conflict, as we mentioned, the Protestants versus Roman Catholic states, but it turned very national. Some states sort of joined into the fray, either as an attempt to liberate themselves from someone else's rule, or because they were moving in because they wanted to acquire more land. And this would be the French who came along later among the notables. The big winner was France, although Sweden and the Netherlands also benefited greatly. Sweden was a military power at this time, and the Netherlands actually gained their freedom, I believe it was from Spain, if I have my history correct, during the course of this 30 Years' War. They were able to liberate themselves from rule. There was a series of treaties which ended the war. It wasn't just one treaty, again, because now you've got basically all of the nation states of Western Europe that are involved at some point or other in this 30 Years' War. And so there's a series of treaties that ended the war. And then the balance of power that comes out of the 30 Years' War actually establishes the balance of power in Western Europe for a long time after that. So France was the big winner, right? This is 1648, right? And then France is very powerful all the way up through it and to Napoleon, right? Which is 1789, I think, French Revolution. And so this is, you know, a century, almost a century and a half, that the results of the 30 Years' War affects the politics and the dynamics of Western Europe. And also at this time, there was a relative peace between Protestantism and Roman Catholicism. So we don't see any more of these battles, these theological battles being waged on the battlefields since 1648. So it seems like Western Europe wised up and settled down a little bit. So that's the Counter-Reformation, about 103 years, 1545 to 1648. And so, as I said, next week we'll pick up and we'll start talking about the details of the Council of Trent.